Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 57, Hyper-V for the Beginner. Here we go. Today my guest is Chris Henley. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing very well, Rick. It's nice to be with you this morning.
Awesome, awesome. And now, Chris, I'll admit you're my peer now, finally.
Yes, we have happy to be there.
Awesome. We've expanded our group here at Veeam. And Chris, can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Chris Henley. I am an IT pro evangelist at heart and spent the past 20 years working in technology. Started early on in Southern California area building networks, really started getting involved in Windows Server, and that became my specialty. Transitioned from building networks into teaching about building networks, and 9 years ago started working with Microsoft on a team that they had called their seminar sales team, which was very much, you know, Windows Server focused. I started teaching about Active Directory when Active Directory was really new for Microsoft back, early 2000s time frame. Started pushing the Active Directory adoption, and then actually watched as the whole virtualization space kind of came into being. Got to mess around with all kinds of neat technologies and have a lot of fun. I spent several years working in that same seminar sales team, and then in another team at Microsoft called the Developer and Platform Evangelism Team, which is quite a name, mm-hmm. but what it really means is promoting new technologies. And over the past couple of years, my focus has been very, very heavy around Hyper-V, around virtualization, and around Microsoft's cloud technologies. About, 6 months ago now, this company called Veeam came out and said, hey, we're going to make our backup and replication product provide support for Hyper-V. And I had seen the cool things that Veeam had done in the VMware world with backup and replication. I honestly think they are the thought leaders in that space. And I said, all right, maybe it's time to take a look at Veeam. Started talking with Doug Hazelman, who's now my boss. Got to meet Rick, did a little bit of interview and work, and the rest, I guess, is going to be history. Looking forward to some fun working with Veeam, and absolutely love working with virtualization.
Yeah, great. And, officially, for the masses, welcome aboard. I guess it was it right after Thanksgiving that you started?
Actually, just before Christmas, December 12th.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I can't quite remember.
But, yeah, it all blends.
Yeah, it does all blend together, and it feels like it's been a whole year or two now, right?
Rick's introduced me to this concept called Veeam Speed, and what I realized is that, that idea of we do more before 6 a.m. than most people do all day, that's a reality.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of interesting. Chris, and this is great, right? We're gonna really talk about Hyper-V today. Granted, your focus is more Hyper-V, mine's more VMware in our duties here at Veeam, but I still have a great appreciation for Hyper-V and the Microsoft technologies. And I want to point out something that you brought up that actually kind of struck me. Back in that early 2000 time, right, that the the early Active Directory and then even a step before that with Exchange 5.5 and the global address list, right, that Active Directory 0.01, version. But I still to this day, I love Active Directory and group policy and all that stuff. And I say this, and maybe you'll appreciate it, but I really think that's one of the best products Microsoft's ever made. And
oh, absolutely.
It's just, it really enables so much more than just logging on and doing everything. Applications plug into it. VMware leverages it. It's a great framework. I love Active Directory and group policy.
Yeah, it's interesting you would start there because I honestly think that's the perfect place to begin a discussion of virtualization. I think you're probably aware the statistics are rampant. I believe the vast majority in the 95% range of virtual machines are running Windows Server. Mm-hmm. And so that environment, the whole idea of being able to have, authentication of a user, authorization or access to resources, that kind of seems to be the core component of what we now define as modern network, right?
Sure.
Virtualization is that, another piece of that allows that to continue to occur, at a lesser cost and maybe more easy to manage, kind of pace. But really, it all still comes back to that same basic technology. we might approach it a little differently, right? Hyper-V has a different architecture than VMware does, and you know, they use different file system sets and you know some different tools for management. But overall, it really comes back to that basic, you know, give me best quality network operations in the easiest possible manner.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, yeah, you're right. They couldn't be more different, really, right? But the disciplines are the same. There's a lot of storage planning, but you have to do it differently. Yep. You have to give a lot of thought to the management, but the tools are totally different. But you know, you can end up, you know, delivering services with both platforms. And you know, with Hyper-V, a lot of people, I think, you know, are kind of you know, started with their VMware journey, and there's plenty of people that really haven't started virtualization at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for that beginner, right, you know, this typical IT pro might be, you know, the Windows Server admin, that type of person, and they've got a, you know, small or even a medium-sized large enterprise, and there are people out there that haven't even started with virtualization. I mean, when it comes to Hyper-V today, I really think that there are a lot of options that you can do. You know, like with any journey with virtualization, you have to put some planning points into that journey, right? So
yeah.
Off the top of my head, I can think of planning storage, planning access, planning protection, and we all have those options right now with Hyper-V. Is there any other big thing that you could think of when somebody's just getting started with Hyper-V that they need to think about?
You know, one of the things that I always begin with in a discussion of Hyper-V is, do you understand the architecture? And I honestly think that that's really the key question, because it starts to define all of those planning processes you just talked about.
Yeah.
And with Microsoft, they took an approach to the architecture behind Hyper-V that's dramatic. Well, I guess fairly dramatically different from what VMware had done. And Microsoft uses an approach called a microkernelized architecture, and I know that sounds like it might be related to the Microsoft kernel somehow, but not really. Microkernelized architecture simply means that when you start looking at a virtualization system, we'll call them a hypervisor because that's what the industry calls it. When you look at a hypervisor and you start to design this architectural model, you have the hardware first. And then you're going to have a hypervisor that actually lays right on top of that hardware. And then you're going to load operating systems on top of the hypervisor. And the hypervisor is actually going to be responsible for taking those calls, passing them down through to the physical hardware, and then routing them back up to the appropriate operating system. And in the Microsoft world, when they design Hyper-V, the way the architecture works, we actually don't have one shared set of drivers that sit down in that hypervisor layer, or one virtualization stack that sits down in that hypervisor layer. Because in their design, in their architecture, they decided, no, instead of putting all of that stuff in a, you know, in a single spot, we're going to actually break that out. And so the first virtual machine that you install, or the first operating system that you install, because frankly, you have to have an operating system before you can install the hypervisor. It's an interesting kind of irony. That first operating system, it's usually called the parent operating system, and that parent operating system will have its own set of proprietary drivers and its own virtualization stack. And then when you come along and you install the second virtual machine, it's going to have its own set of proprietary drivers. It's not going to have its own virtualization stack. It's actually going to look back to the parent mm-hmm. for that. Each individual virtual machine that comes online, we're going to add its own individual proprietary set of drivers. Now, on the surface, you look at that and think, well, that's kind of silly. That seems like you're redundantly adding essentially the same set of drivers to interact with this host hardware over and over again. Might be a waste of space, might be a waste of time, might make management more challenging. Certainly going to make portability of the virtual machine a little bit more challenging. Why do it? And Microsoft's reasoning behind this was, hey, we want to be able to provide an environment that's got isolation capabilities. And so you can run those virtual machines entirely isolated from one another, and in fact, isolated at least from a driver and stack perspective from the hypervisor that they're running on top of.
Well, the one thing that catches me on that, though, is that, you know, the driver base really isn't that big of a deal, in my opinion, simply because, you know, specifically in Windows, there's so many built in,
right?
So it's not, don't let that sound like there's extra work, I guess is
no.
what I'm trying to say.
That's true. Now, there's actually benefits that come from this, and long term, the benefits that come out of that architecture are that as you start running a Hyper-V environment, those machines are actually independent of one another. You could isolate them from one another on physical hardware sets. You could isolate them from one another logically. You can isolate them as we start moving ahead into a cloud-style environment, geographically and functionally. And that's really a big benefit. When you start talking about, I know, Rick, you're big into storage hardware, right?
Yeah.
When you start talking about a SAN, for example, it's not just one disk, right? You've got a whole, you're working with arrays of disks in most cases, and the ability to isolate operations on separate functional disks or separate spindles really becomes important when you start talking about performance.
It does. But I got to stop you. You said a cuss word on my podcast. Wow. That's taboo, man. No, I'm just teasing. Cloud's not a, it's not a foul word in this podcast, no.
So,
but you know, the storage, it comes up so many times, and this is one of those decision points that will transcend VMware and Hyper-V technologies, because it brings Citrix Zen Server into the conversation. It's the same. It doesn't matter. You have to really give probably your most planning to storage,
sure,
more so than probably any other component of your virtualization journey. And because things are abstracted on the hypervisor and the guest operating systems therein, you may actually have abstraction on disk, right? So virtualized storage technologies. It drives me crazy when I see some arcane application requirement that says, oh, it must be RAID 10, this many RPMs. actually something more ridiculous, like must be RAID 5, right? I'm like, well, first of all, RAID 5 is dead. If anybody's still using RAID 5, by the way, consider RAID 6 with larger drives, rebuild times. It's kind of a risk to be at RAID 5. Side note off my soapbox. Abstraction and virtualization in the storage realm is just going to get more sophisticated. And then when we talk about virtualization, having that view into the architecture that you've gone into is actually very important. And actually, I learned something along the way there about the Hyper-V implementation of that abstraction. But I have to ask you a question.
Yep.
And maybe you don't know, and that's fine. But does that apply both to like Windows Server 2008 add Hyper-V role and Hyper-V OS, or does it depend?
No, it doesn't depend, and I actually do know that. So when you start talking about Hyper-V Server and you compare it and contrast it to adding the Hyper-V role in, say, you know, Windows Standard or Enterprise or Data Center Edition, architecturally we do exactly the same thing. Hyper-V plays that same micro-kernelized architecture throughout its implementations. Even at the standard enterprise data center, same architectural implementation across all three sets. And the same holds true when you go to the free edition with Hyper-V Server. You know, since we're on the topic, this is probably something that we should talk about. People ask me all the time. I kind of started taking it for granted about a year or so ago. One of the things that's really quite fascinating about Hyper-V is that Microsoft has a, I don't know if it's stated anywhere, but there's certainly an internal belief at Microsoft that Hyper-V should be free, that the hypervisor component should have no cost associated with it, which is really kind of, you know, opposite of what traditional Microsoft thinking is, right? They license every product. Mm-hmm. They want to have a cost per use model. However, in this case, with the hypervisor, that's not the case. And so as you start thinking about, hey, I might consider running Hyper-V, Rick, you brought it up, the first option that we generally start thinking of is, okay, maybe we start with a Hyper-V server, which is a free download. That gives us the hypervisor. then we just license the operating systems that we're going to run as virtual machines in that Hyper-V environment, which I really kind of think is great. I think that's an appropriate way to run a virtualized hypervisor style environment. Microsoft actually even goes further, and depending on the licenses that you use with your Windows Server, if you're running, say, Windows Standard Edition Server, they have a 1+1 licensing model where you pay for a single license, you install the Windows Server on your physical hardware, and you add the Hyper-V role, and your license includes the ability to run an additional virtual machine at no cost on that Hyper-V server. When you go to enterprise, it's a 1+4 model, so you get the one physical license and then four additional servers. And then as you go to data center, the model becomes 1+ as many as you want. Now, I'm not trying to promote Microsoft licensing, don't get me wrong. I simply want you to be aware when you start thinking about Hyper-V and a hypervisor design, they approach things possibly a little different than, you know, what you might see out of VMware.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Well, and the thing is that honestly, it's, you know, VRAM aside, it's not really simple on either end. Because then we're talking about enrollment for core infrastructure, right, which is your management stack on the Hyper-V, Microsoft and Hyper-V side.
Right.
And then you've got Windows Server CALs, right? So, and then there's user CALs, right? And then your applications, that doesn't really go away between Hyper-V or vSphere. So,
and no matter what you do, you're going to run into those.
Yeah. So it, I guess the only easy licensing is Veeam Backup, and it's per processor. That's the only thing we need to worry about. So.
We need to start pushing that in the rest of the network world.
Well, and you know, you bring up a second point, Chris, and that's that, you know, the free Hyper-V server, what I call Hyper-V operating system, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one that's not starting from a Windows server, add the role. It is the Hyper-V only. It's the one you can get for free. That one does not include any Windows Server CALs, right? So
No Windows Server CALs with that.
Yeah, so if you are playing with that, you know, keep that in mind. But also, if you are playing with that, keep in mind that Veeam will actually back that up. So that is supported with our V6 backup for Hyper-V, which I'll be honest with you, Chris, I'm using it a little bit. It's pretty slick. It leverages VSS, right? It's a really clean, you know, good framework to leverage for this type of application. And I'm using it in the lab here. It works great because I do some kind of crazy things in the lab here. You won't get mad at me, but a lot of people give me funny looks. For example, I run my vCenter virtual machine on Hyper-V. I run my System Center VM on vSphere. Okay, so I'm doing things a little bit backwards, a little bit on purpose. They make great learning examples. But, it's great to kind of take a look into the Hyper-V realm. And, you know, and if we're talking to someone who's, you know, thinking about getting started with Hyper-V, these are very important points, right? Get your head around the architecture. Get your head around how you're going to manage it, right? Because that problem exists in both realms. You know, now that you've consolidated and abstracted, how are you going to have that visibility in, right? You can still walk through the computer room and look for yellow lights, but then that might impact more things, right? So think of the whole stack. As you go forward and identify requirements, because this happened in the VMware realm, you know, and I can say this from experience, right, that we quickly jumped into this virtualized and consolidated world, and then some of the other, like, core metrics that we would do, right, like alerting, monitoring, and some of these other things were kind of put aside in the interest of immediate capital expenditure savings, right? So, I mean, we benefited from that, but we might not have been addressing all the normal practice points as we went forward. So, you know, in your experience, Chris, do you have a good, like, Hyper-V lesson learned story you could share that you've seen,
you know,
or gone through yourself?
It's interesting you should ask, you know, the way that you just said that. Probably my biggest individual lesson learned early on, with the release of Hyper-V version 1.0, being at Microsoft, I heard clients state all of those things you just said. Oh, we're going to implement this because we're going to save so much on capital expenditures. The consolidation function is going to save us a tremendous amount in license cost and operations cost, you know, hardware maintenance, management costs. There was this perception that we were going to save all this money. And while that's certainly true when it comes to a capital expense, you know, layout or outlay, I don't know that we really saw the future of what virtualization would do. In my experience, yeah, we certainly saved money from a capital expenditure point of view. We're not buying as many new physical servers, not buying as much storage space per se. We're not, you know, we might not be buying as much hardware, but I also can tell you from a server sprawl perspective, while there's not more physical servers, I'm sure we're talking about a whole lot more virtual machines. The ratio for management and the workload for me as an administrator went through the roof. Instead of managing, you know, say 20 to 30 servers, we're now starting to talk about server management measured more towards hundreds of servers.
Yeah, everyone goes up. It always goes up, your number of OSs. So that brings up a good point, right? The complete, dare I say, private cloud cuss word, right? The private cloud.
Oh, you just said cloud on your own show.
I know. I'm just messing with you. But
I'm a bad influence.
No, that's fine. But if you have your own infrastructure practice, it has to be able to scale, right? So
yeah.
In my experience, I saw the number of OSEs, the number of operating system environments, double.
Yep.
In both times that I pretty much went from zero to, you know, high percentage virtualization. In the course of that, the number of operating systems doubled, right? So
yep.
Think about everything, antivirus protection, right? Update management, data protection, right? Everything
yes.
gets impacted when you are dealing with, you know, 100%, you know, growth and hyper growth, whatever you want to call it. So I guess that first step into virtualization is kind of like a pre-flight checkoff because it's going to take off after that.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I think that's a great thing, especially in light of the fact that it obviously says something about our industry, right? As we start looking at the growth of virtual machines, as soon as we take away the expenditure, obviously our businesses have been clamoring for more in terms of services, in terms of application support, user support, whatever. Obviously, the fact that we take away the capital expenditure costs for the physical hardware and the first thing that happens is a doubling of operating systems, I'm assuming that our industry really wants more, right? And we weren't giving it to them because there was a cost. You take the cost away, hey, we can start to drive better business. So I really do think that it's not necessarily a bad thing that we see that kind of growth, but you do need to be aware that it's going to happen, and you certainly need to be prepared to manage it.
Absolutely. And, you know, cost is an important thing, but then, you know, bundle that around the service catalog that becomes possible with your virtualization technologies. And I think it's a no-brainer that this is the way to go. You can deploy it better. You can manage it better. You can protect it better. I guess the analogy, and you might have heard this, Chris, right? Because sometimes people might say, well, if I'm like adding up all the different things that I'm doing for my virtual environment, it might end up being more expensive than doing it in a physical world. In some situations, I've seen that kind of happen. And then the example comes up like, well, here, look at this fancy Android or Apple phone, right? It's more expensive
yeah.
than this pay-as-you-go mobile, but look at all the features you get, right?
Yep.
So you look at it that way. I think Ratmir did that, our CEO did that in a press interview one time. So I love using that analogy because it makes perfect sense to me.
Sure.
So, hey, Chris, we do keep it nice and short here. You're always welcome back on the podcast, but I'm not going to let you off the hook without my gimmick. I have I have three questions that I'm going to ask you, and these are you
okay.
just generally as a technologist, right? There's
yep.
no right or wrong answer, but it's a way for the listeners to get to know you a little bit better.
Sure.
So I'm going to start in the past. As a technologist, what was the most interesting role, story, or technical experience that you were doing at some point that you could share with us?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, one of my favorite experiences in the past, I told you I worked in Southern California, and I got to do some work with the Walt Disney Company when they were doing their initial rollout of Active Directory. And, you know, from a work perspective, what an amazing opportunity. I mean, that company is enormous in terms of its size of operations from a technology perspective, to be involved in watching them roll an Active Directory environment out. And you talk about group policy. I'll share a fun example. I didn't build this. I was simply told about it while I was working with that organization. Apparently, Disney, when they rolled out Active Directory, decided to implement a group policy solution for all of the desktop machines in their environment. And it was so successful at eliminating common problems that they were actually able to consolidate their global help desks and save a significant amount of money because they no longer needed them. So, you know, Amazing how things happen. You know, a piece of technology comes out, you put it into practice, and, you know, the world changes.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a great story. I love hearing things where, like, group policy in particular. I don't know. I love that technology. It's great. I do everything through group policy.
Tease about it. It's all of our internal Darth Vader. We all love group policy.
Nice. How about today and in the present? What's going on with you right now that you most have the most passion for technology-wise?
You know, Hyper-V is my passion right now. I honestly think I'm going to make some bold predictions. Right now, VMware, as you're well aware, has a pretty strong position in the virtualization market space. Hyper-V, fantastic tool. I love what VMware does. I love the way that VMware operates. I really like to look into the future of what's going to happen. I really see Hyper-V stepping up because of its cost, its ease of use, whatever. I think you're going to see a kind of evening out of the market positions between those two. I'm not going to say that one's better than the other because I honestly don't know that that's the case. But I do know that putting those two side by side in a marketplace is going to drive innovation that I can't wait to see.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, take that one step further, and I think we both agree that there's room for both.
Yes, okay? Absolutely.
So there's there's a huge opportunity for people to virtualize, right? It's not like It's not like we're done, right? We're never done with virtualization. There's always something more to virtualize. So.
And not only are we not done, but I think we're really just getting started.
For sure, for sure. How about into the future? What do you see coming down the path technology-wise that, gets you, you're most excited for into the future?
You know, one of the things that I love most, I've been an internet kid forever. I loved, you know, even early on when the internet was a, you know, dial-up modem prospect, I was calling to the University of Utah, which happened to be my closest link to that internet world, and, you know, using bulletin board systems for communication, that kind of stuff. I loved that then and kind of started to see some of the potential. Looking at what you have today, I think internet as a communication mechanism really has a long, long way to go. I'll be the first to admit, I'm really surprised that we're still using static-based HTML, even HTML5-based technologies to run an internet. We're really still reading newspapers instead of making the leap to the next big thing. I see some of it out there, right? I see all of the major television networks pushing their content to an internet environment. I see Apple and their iPad integration into online forums and trying to eliminate the text-based world and go to an application-based environment. You can see, you know, Google with their FaceTime, Skype with their, you know, video communication. There's a lot of applications out there that if we just give them a little bit more time to mature, I think we see a major leap in the internet as a communication, media dissemination, entertainment, you know, that type of world. And that's what I'm really excited for.
Yeah.
I mean, we're doing a podcast. You're in Ohio. I'm in Salt Lake City. We're using Skype and a recording device. I'm guessing if you wanted, you could publish this live online, right?
Yeah, but I never do it live because I always mess something up. You don't
Somebody's
want me
going to say cloud.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I had to bleep a guy out recently, so other than that, I'm not wild about live. So
Yeah.
But no, that's
I really love what's coming.
That's a great view into the future, Chris. And I think that I guess the word I'm looking for is, you know, full public discourse. Really, it's the full channel of everything. Okay. We're real close. It's almost there. I think the biggest issue really is ubiquitous connectivity.
Yeah.
Right.
It is.
The phones are pretty good, right? But 3G is not good enough to really take it the next way, and then maybe 4G or whatever is next, right? It'll come.
Yep.
It'll happen. We don't know. I don't know what it is, but it'll be there.
So. You do know that ubiquitous connectivity is one of the five components of cloud, right?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is.
Well, whose definition of cloud, right? There's a few of them out there, I would imagine.
That's the National Institute of Standards and Technology definition.
Oh,
I only use theirs.
Well, hey, Chris, this has been a great podcast. I appreciate your time on the show. Everyone, you can follow Chris on Twitter at NerdyLikeThat, and I'll put a link to his Twitter feed in the podcast notes. You can also find Chris contributing at the Veeam blog at veeam.com/blog. Thanks again for being on the show, Chris.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rick.